I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Missouri is joining the ranks of states permitting the growth, sale, and use of medical marijuana. The response from potential investors has been enthusiastic, to say the least. Today, a closer look at what it will take to win one of the limited number of licenses for cultivators. Applicants have had to ante up a hefty fee and a ton of paperwork. We'll ask if it will all be worthwhile and if supply will meet demand. Then, a small eatery on Troost started a pay-what-you-can system a year ago this week. We'll revisit our conversation about Thelma's Kitchen and then get an update on how the cafe and the community are doing. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. In 2018, Missouri voters became one of 35 states to legalize the medicinal use of marijuana. In the 9 months since that vote, potential patients have been applying for the required ID cards. Vendors are paying non-refundable fees in the thousands of dollars to be among the 192 officially licensed dispensaries throughout the state. It's all moving pretty fast, but if the first legal cannabis will be available for purchase in early 2020, as officials hope, someone has to grow it. No license will be tougher to get or more expensive to apply for than the 60 designated slots for cultivators. Today, we're looking at what it takes to be a legal commercial pot grower in Missouri. Talking with the folks who have had various interests in the process, Jack Cardetti has been a spokesman and advocate for legalizing medical marijuana in Missouri. He's now with MOCAN Trade, which is the Industry Trade Association. Jack, welcome back to KCUR.
Great. Thanks for having me on today.
We're also talking with Lyndall Fraker. He's director of medical marijuana with the state's Department of Health and Senior Services. He joins us from Jefferson City. Director Fraker, welcome. Are you there?
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
We're glad you're here. And also Dr. Paul Calicote. He's a retired interventional cardiologist who also happens to be applying to be a cannabis cultivator himself, also a manufacturer and dispenser in the current application process. Dr. Calicote, he joins us from his home near Joplin. Welcome to you.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Glad you're all here. Jack, let me start with you. Amendment 2 passed last November. Where are we on the road from legalization to actually seeing medical marijuana for sale across the state?
Yeah, like you mentioned, 35 states now have some form of medical cannabis, including Missouri, where it passed with 66%. A lot of those states, quite frankly, have found it a lot easier to pass the law than they have to implement the law. In many states, the implementation has been marred by delays, confusions, litigations. Fortunately, we're not seeing that here in Missouri. It's been a really smooth implementation. Director Fraker and those of the Department of Health deserve a lot of credit for making that go smoothly so far.
Why is it so complicated in other states?
Yeah, a lot of times what you have is you have a rules process where they come up with rules and regulations. They have to set up a merit-based application. And a lot of times politics has come involved and confusion and delay. Here in Missouri, the department's done a couple, I think, really smart things. One is they've said, hey, these applications, they're going to be blind applications. We're going to redact names and information. We're also going to have a third party actually do the scoring of these. So it won't be state officials picking winners or losers here. It'll be a third party that really is going to grade these based solely on merit. That's what we want the program to be about.
It sounds like the industry, which is what you represent, is actually pretty happy with how the process is going from state regulators. That you don't see that all the time.
You don't see that all the time. But I think that a lot of that is a result of the collaborative process that the department has gone through. They've sought a lot of outreach. They've done public forums. They've taken input. And as a result, we're hoping to implement one of the best medical marijuana programs in the country. And this next week, when people are applying for those, that's really a culmination of a lot of people's entrepreneurial dreams. And it's a really exciting time right now.
Well, let's talk about that with Lyndall Fraker, who directs the office that's handling all these applications for licenses. We're talking mostly today about the cultivator license, and that application period is open for a two-week period that's going on right now. I know there was also a pre-filing period. Director Fraker, what are you seeing in terms of applications?
Well, Brian, we've received 81 applications as of this morning. Certainly, we're, I believe, in the 10th day of the time frame to accept those applications. It will end at 11:59 this coming Saturday night. So You know, we kind of expected to see more by this time in the process, but we'll see how it goes the next 4 or 5 days.
Well, and you haven't seen as many applications as you expected, but a lot of people have prepaid their filing fees, right?
Correct. Yes, we're over 600 pre-file applications, which began on January the 5th. And so there's a lot of folks that we anticipated that would have their full-fledged application in by now in this 2-week period, but they haven't. So we'll see how it goes.
Do you have a sense of why they're delaying that?
Well, I think the application process is fairly sophisticated. There's quite a bit of information there that needs to be entered properly, and I think many are taking their time to make sure they do that. They've had those forms and rules and application out there since the 1st of June, but I think as it comes down to the deadline, you know, many are fine-tuning and dotting all their I's and crossing their T's, so I believe we'll see a big rash here in the next few days.
Well, you know, if you do see that big rash, you're probably going to see more applications than you have licenses to award. The state has said it will only grant 60 licenses, which was the minimum under the amendment, the initiative that passed in November. Why only 60 licenses?
The Constitution's fairly clear that we are to issue those minimum amounts unless we deem that they won't be sufficient to meet the needs of the patients of Missouri. That's how we read the amendment, what is now the Constitution, Article 14. And so we believe we need to give those numbers a chance to meet the supply and demand. You know, those numbers were done by the drafters in a very methodical, thorough way. And so there was a reason for those numbers. They weren't just pulled out of the air.
Sure. And so you're going to have to make some decisions. How are you going to go about choosing among all of these applicants? What's the process for deciding which licenses to award?
Well, the blind scoring, as Jack mentioned a minute ago, with the third party vendor doing the actual scoring, that's the process that's going to be utilized. We felt like it was very, very important to have that transparency and have those independent folks, you know, taking that endeavor on. It's certainly going to be a big job, and we just felt it was that important.
But you obviously have to. I'm sorry. You have to. I know there's a little delay in our conversation too, so I'm sorry about that.
No problem.
I imagine yes, you'll have an outside scorer, but you obviously had to develop the criteria, the things for which someone is awarded points. What is it you value versus what you don't value as much in making that decision?
Sure. Well, again, the drafters gave us a real good foundation, a good structure to start with. So there were 10 categories that were listed in the amendment that said we would utilize categories such as the character, veracity, background, qualification, relevant experience of officers and managers, categories like security, experience in a legal cannabis market, and so forth. So we had that as a basis to work from to develop our scoring procedure, and we had, quite frankly, a team of attorneys working on this for several months, and they researched other states, they looked at law and did all kinds of things to build this scoring system to make it fair and equitable.
So one of the people who we know is applying through that process is Dr. Paul Calicote. I understand you're applying not only for a cultivator license, but also for other licenses, right?
Yeah, that's correct. We're applying for cultivation, infusion, and dispensary licenses. We want to be fully integrated.
So how'd you get involved in this business? Why do you want to be part of Missouri's medical marijuana industry?
My son drugged me into it.
Well, we've heard that before. How'd that happen?
Well, I had retired from my practice and was living down here in solitude. And my son had gotten involved with the first amendment that didn't get enough signatures to get on the ballot. I think it was back in 2015, something like that. But he went to the West Coast, learned to grow medical marijuana out there, and came back with an idea to get into the cannabis industry here in Missouri, hoping that it was going to pass this time, and came up with an idea to grow cannabis in the form of hops and then transition into marijuana. I wasn't really that excited about it, but thought it might be a good opportunity for him to learn some business skills. So I offered to fund him, and I looked at it as a year of grad school in business. And so as he was getting geared up to grow hops up in Kansas City, I started doing research in, you know, I just figured it was a bunch of hippies wanting to get high. And so I started doing research, as a scientist would, into medical marijuana and realized that, yes, indeed, marijuana does have medicinal characteristics, certainly multiple benefits in different disease processes. And I just got intrigued by it. And then, you know, as Jack said, the drafters, and Mr. Fraker said, the drafters of the Amendment 2, I mean, this is a stellar job. This, in my mind, this is the best amendment, the best proposition in the country. I mean, they took the best and the worst of all the other amendments and all the other propositions that had come through for medical marijuana, combined it into Amendment 2. It's just extremely well written. It gives people like me an opportunity to write a business plan around it. Unlike other states, Colorado, for example, you can, you know, pay your license fee and then grow as much marijuana as you want to. Here in the state with 60 cultivation, or in Missouri with the 60 cultivation licenses, there's actually going to be a limit on the crop that we can produce. And so, you know, the supply-demand thing.
So I want to ask you, Jack, I mean, how typical is Dr. Calicoat among those who are applying to be cultivators, and for that matter, manufacturers and dispensers? He's getting into this because his son drug him into it. He has not got a background in marijuana production. How typical is that of what we're going to see in those who are applying in Missouri?
Yeah, I mean, the nice thing about this program, there is no typical applicant. We've seen them from all different backgrounds, all different shapes of life. And that's, I think, something that really is going to be beneficial. First and foremost, Amendment 2 and the medical marijuana program here is about helping patients, right? And so people that are suffering from epilepsy, PTSD, HIV, cancer, other ailments are going to get relief and have a substitute for opioids in a lot of instances. That's important. That's why the amendment passed. But there's a second benefit here, and that's the economic opportunity that this is going to provide throughout the state. And then we're really excited about that, excited that people from different backgrounds like Dr. Calicoat and others right here in Kansas City are going to be really on the ground floor of this industry.
I want to invite our listeners to ask their questions. What are your questions about Missouri's journey toward legal medical marijuana? Have you thought about getting into the business yourself? What do you still feel like you need to know? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888, and you can talk with the state officials and representatives of the trade industry who are here to talk about legal medical marijuana in Missouri. Director Fraker, I'm curious. I mean, you have mentioned that among the criteria that you're using to determine who can get these licenses, one of them at least, is relevant experience. You have to be able to have some confidence that they know what they're doing and that they'll do this well. On the other hand, we hear from folks like Dr. Calicoat that they're just getting into the business for the first time. How are you balancing those concerns? I know you can't comment on his application in particular, but how are you ensuring that mom-and-pop businesses like his, perhaps, really can succeed in this process?
Well, in that application process, there will be attachments. There will be information that will be asked for by the applicant.
Uh-oh. It sounds like we're losing connection with Lyndall Fraker. We'll come back. We'll work on that connection. Are you there, Lyndall Fraker?
I'm here. Okay. I can hear you fine.
We can hear you again now. Go ahead.
Yeah. Sorry.
It's all right.
Okay. Yes. No problem. The application will have will give them an opportunity to speak to that issue. Many applicants, it appears, maybe have managers or employees that have worked in the industry in other states. But of course, the ownership is still a 51% Missouri resident ownership. But there are many that are bringing folks in that have that experience, and there's a place in the application for that and in the scoring piece for that. So, again, this was in the amendment. It wasn't something that we drafted on our own, and so we're following the Constitution with that.
Yeah, you know, the amendment also set these application fees, right? You've collected, how much money have you collected in application fees so far?
Well, we're north of $4 million, 4.6, I believe, and it's over 600 pre-application fees.
So how are you? What are you doing to make sure that money's being used for its intended purpose? And maybe you should tell us what that intended purpose is.
That's a good question, and we're always proud to answer that one. You know, the amendment itself was drafted with a 4% tax that would go to the veterans, in addition to your regular sales tax that would go to the local city, county, and the state governments. But also, it says that the license fees and application fees, renewal fees, could also go to the veterans after all expenses are paid. Mm-hmm. And so it's our goal to set our budget and be off. We're trying to monitor that fund and make sure we spend, you know, as little as possible to get the program up and running in a very efficient manner.
Paul Calicote, I'm curious, you know, I know you're waiting to hear how your application turns out, but let's say you do get the application approved and you become one of these 60 cultivators. What do you do next? I don't know anything about the process of actually starting a commercial operation like this.
You start growing marijuana. I'm not sure I quite understand your question about what.
So do you already have the land? Do you already know how you're going to make that happen?
We do, and we are a mom and pop. We're a family-owned business. We purchased a nursery, a ornamental tree nursery called Sarcoxie Nursery down here in Sarcoxie, Missouri, and we are currently building structures to start cultivating medical marijuana if we're lucky enough to be awarded a license. We have a time frame where we would like to be one of the first to roll out with product to the market. We know that there's going to be a lot of patients that are very anxious quickly. You know, as soon as January 1st hits, people are going to start wanting to buy medical marijuana, and that's just not going to be possible until you plant it, grow it, cure it, process it, and package it. So there's going to be a lot of steps involved, probably, hopefully, start rolling out product, June, July, August, somewhere in that time frame. As far as consultants that you were mentioning before, you're right. I don't know a whole lot about growing medical marijuana. I do know a lot about building a business. My wife has a lot of skills in building the business with me as far as our interventional cardiac catheterization lab and medical practice previously. My son has experience growing medical marijuana, and we have multiple out-of-state consultants available to us in person as well as by phone. We've put what we think is an excellent foundation and an excellent business plan in play, and if we're lucky enough to get one, we're ready to start rolling.
That seems like the key, to have some folks with experience from outside the state but still have the in-state ownership to be an attractive application.
Yeah, we're 100% in-state owned. We're family owned, so, and we're proud of that.
I'm also curious from you, and I'll ask Jack the same question, but you know, Paul, you're doing something that under federal law is still, at least in theory, illegal, growing marijuana. Does that give you pause about building a business on this?
It's not theory. It's definitely federally illegal. It does give me pause. I mean, there are roadblocks. The federal government, in my mind, they just don't care anymore. The enforcement of the federal policies is, in my mind, again, over. The big drawback right now is insurance and banking. You know, if you're a federally insured bank, you can't do any business with a medical marijuana company. So the cash aspect's a big drawback, but that's, you know, you can't get loans from banks, you can't do payroll and such. So that's the drawback from the federal government. But as far as the federal government coming in and penalizing me, arresting me, I don't fear that at all.
Jack, is that pretty much the standard response to the fact that this is still illegal under federal law?
Yeah, actually, we've seen some movement out in D.C. The last 3 or 4 years, they've passed something as part of the budget process in the federal government that doesn't allow the DOJ to expend any resources to go after legal medical marijuana states. Not true of the adult use states, but there are definite protections for medical marijuana operators. But there are still challenges, and banking being the number one, as Dr. Calicote has talked about.
Let's take calls from a few of our listeners who've been standing by. Let's talk to John in Lee's Summit. Hi, John.
Hi.
What's your question about medical marijuana in Missouri?
So I just had a quick question. As it becomes more prevalent, what plans does the state have in place for testing for driving under the influence of medical marijuana?
Let me ask Lyndall Fraker, as the state official here with us, is that something the state has thought about?
Yes, it is. We've actually been working with the Highway Patrol and the Missouri Sheriffs and the Police Chiefs Associations to work out all the details on how it will affect law enforcement and how they take care of those kinds of issues and have been with other various intoxicants or that type of thing. I know that the Highway Patrol has been very, very eager to put together a guidebook and a handbook for their troopers, and I don't have that information myself at this point, but that will be worked out, and they I feel very confident that they will be able to answer or deal with that issue.
We have another call from Rick.
Of course, the one thing I might mention too, Brian. Nothing changes on the illegal. Yeah, nothing changes on the illegal side of marijuana. It's still all in place as far as driving under the influence or even being impaired at work. Nothing changes with that. We're just carving a piece of the marijuana industry out and making it legal for medicinal purposes.
Let's talk to Rick in Independence, who has another question about regulations. Rick?
Good morning.
Good morning.
The THC content is found to be between 2 and 3%. And already we've discovered that some growers, corporate-minded, have been fortifying it up to 30%.
Okay, so your question is about how to make sure that the percentage, the strength of the THC in the drug is within the appropriate boundaries. Lyndall Fraker, how do you respond to that?
Well, that's why we're going to be licensing testing facilities. The amendment called for 2 testing facilities, and that's the one area that we made the decision to license up to 10 if we get good qualified applicants. We think it's that important. And so, you know, if a facility says that they're going to have X number content of THC, then it has to have that. I mean, we'll, with our testing, that's our plan, is to monitor that.
Let's take one more quick question from Frank in Lawrence. Frank, thanks for calling in.
How do you decide how much marijuana can somebody buy, medical marijuana? How often can they buy it? And how do you prevent that from going recreational after they buy it? Thank you, answer off here.
Thank you. Appreciate it. And that's a question a lot of folks are wondering, both the numbers, but also how you keep this to be medical use. Mr. Director Fraker?
If it goes recreational, it won't be under any direction that we've given. It would simply have to be a vote of the people again or done in the legislature.
Right. But under this current law, what are the limits?
Others.
Mm-hmm. Are there limits on how much a person can get?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. The Constitution says that a patient can be certified for 4 ounces per 30 days of flowering plant, and then that would convert over to the other type of products in grams.
And Jack Cardetti,
that's the constitutional amount.
You were a big part of pushing for this amendment when it was first passed by the voters. It was exclusively about medical marijuana. Is there an effort to sort of take this as a stepping stone to recreational use?
Well, I think there's a reason they call it the Show Me State, right? The Missourians voted overwhelmingly, 66%. This was the highest vote getter on the entire ballot. I think they want to make sure that we have a good medical marijuana program, but certainly the politics of these issues are changing. To the last caller, one of the questions on the applications is going to be, how will an applicant prevent diversion, which is what we were talking about, when somebody legally buys medical marijuana, but it would be diverted onto the system. So there's a lot of good. Applicants are going to have to be aware of that issue. They're going to have to tackle it. There's also a good thing the department's done. They're instituting a seed to sales tracking system. So all from the day one when Mr. Calico puts a seed into the ground there, all the way until it's sold at a dispensary, that'll be tracked by the state. That's something that we really think is going to make this a safe program.
I wish we had more time to continue this conversation, but we are out of time. I want to thank our guest, Dr. Paul Calicote, who is applying to be a cultivator as well as manufacturer and dispenser of medical marijuana. Jack Cardetti, who represents the trade group that is working with all those potential growers and sellers. And Lyndall Fraker, who's director of medical marijuana with the state's Department of Health and Senior Services. Thanks to all of you for joining us today.
Thanks, Ryan.
All right, Brian. Thanks.
Thank you, Brian. Appreciate it.
When we come back, a Midtown cafe made headlines last year when it opened with a unique business model: offer lunch for whatever people care to pay. On this week of its first birthday, we'll check in with Thelma's Kitchen about how the concept is playing out. Stay with us. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. And welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. If you haven't signed up for the Up to Date newsletter yet, what are you waiting for? Go to kcur.org/Kraske and subscribe for exclusive weekly content from Steve and highlights from the Up to Date team. It's kcur.org/Kraske. And speaking of him, Steve will be back in the host chair tomorrow as student athletes return to campus and to practice in Kansas and Missouri. Steve and sports contributor Greg Eklund will get you up to speed on the fall season of college sports. The area of Kansas City around 31st and Troost has seen a lot of change and growth over the last few years. Part of that change is coming from a lunch-only restaurant there called Thelma's Kitchen. It's run by the nonprofit Reconciliation Services, and it turns 1 year old this Friday. Today, we'll celebrate that birthday with a conversation about how it's going, but first, we're going to listen back to a conversation that Steve Kraske had last October with a couple of people from that restaurant to get their take on running a cafe and serving the community. Let's listen.
Well, here's an intriguing concept for a restaurant. You pay what you can afford. And if you don't have much money, maybe you volunteer some time. That's the concept of Thelma's Kitchen, a community cafe at 3101 Truce that's named after the woman known in the neighborhood for taking care of others. The cafe builds on Reconciliation Services' 30 years as a community advocate that aims to transform Truce from a dividing line to a gathering place. It's a new concept. But is it working? We're about to find out. Father Justin Matthews is with us. He's Executive Director of Reconciliation Services. Father, great to have you. Welcome.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you for having us.
Pamela Infranca is also here. She's the Food Programs Manager for Thelma's Kitchen. And Pam, nice to have you too. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, Father Matthews, as I just asked, is it working? Is the concept of pay what you can afford panning out?
So Thelma's Kitchen is fantastic, but the way that it's working is nuanced. Sure, it is working as an incredible restaurant. The food is unbelievable. Mm. Pam, as a chef, is off the charts.
I've heard good stories.
And the environment is wonderful. But the real key is bringing the community together. It's all about food and community. So the most important metric for us is, how is that piece working? And that's what I think is most exciting.
And you're saying it is working.
It is working very well and will continue to work as people from all sides and all different communities, both sides of Troost and all different communities, come together and begin to get to know one another, eat together, break bread together. And that's laying the foundation then for deeper relationships and deeper healing in our city.
Well, Pamela, dare I ask, we've just covered the sort of the spiritual side of this. How about the financial side? Is the whole concept panning out?
It is. It's working. We have a great deal of paying customers, and we also have a great deal of walk-in volunteers and also sign-up volunteers who come in. So it's working every day. It's amazing to see.
Are you surprised by that or not?
I am and I'm not. I didn't know what to expect because this is our new restaurant, but we work with One World Everybody Eats, which is a nationwide network of Donate What You Can cafes. There are about 60 of them across the country, and it's a tried and true model. So we just have followed the model, and it's working again.
Who's coming to the restaurant, Father? Who you see walking in the doors?
You know, we see people from east of Troost and west of Troost. White and black, rich and poor, people who have been coming to Reconciliation Services and our free Friday night meal, which we have run for years, which we closed when we opened up Thelma's Kitchen. That model had literally 400 people a Friday coming in, and the key was not to lose one of those friends, to make sure that they understood that this was still for them. What we were trying to do also, though, was to begin to invite other people from other communities to come, not just as volunteers serving behind a counter, but to come as equals, both eating together, both volunteering together, and to begin to break down some of those toxic charity models and to build in equity into the model to deliver both great food and to together build great community where we're not displacing community by doing development.
You know, Pamela, this is a lunch-only operation, if I understand correctly.
Yeah.
Why that approach? Why not offer dinner, as Father Matthews just suggested?
Well, you know, eventually that may happen. We just thought it was kind of a way to start Monday through Friday lunch. It was something in the neighborhood that was lacking. We had done the Friday night meal. I've only been around for about a year, but Reconciliation Services did it for years. But there are a lot of agencies who have evening meals, and lunch is not really covered, so we went that direction.
You know, you're in a part of Truce that's really transforming itself. What are you seeing happening? Because Operation Breakthrough, just to get our listeners oriented here, is just a block or so away.
It's on the other corner.
It's actually across the street.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. What do you see happening on Truce, right where you're located?
Well, it's really exciting. I mean, there's a lot of cleanup going on. There's, you know, seeing what's happening with Operation Breakthrough, just the expanse of, you know, what they need and who they're serving. And so it's kind of exciting up and down Troost if you take a drive.
Father, what are you seeing there?
You know, there are a lot of people moving into the community that has historically been a community that has struggled for many years. And that community is changing. There are good aspects of that, and there are difficult aspects of that. Mm-hmm. And one of the keys is that everyone who moves there is impacting the people who have been there. Mm-hmm. Some of those things, like we've talked about in other conversations where I've read things you've written, you know, some of those things lead to gentrification.
Right.
Like when we put progress over people, that's a negative side of the development on Troost. But what I see happening and what I see as possible with the support of the community is places like Reconciliation Services, Operation Breakthrough, and others really are coming together. Even our friends at Troost Market Collective, who are a group of artists doing incredible muraling, you know, we are working together to make sure that as development happens, that we're not displacing the community. Because, Steve, we have a choice to make right now.
Mm-hmm.
There's a choice for what Troost will be tomorrow. And I think in Kansas City, we have the entrepreneurship, we have the nonprofit generosity and the heart, the spirit, but we also have the business acumen to be able to do social venturing and to be able to have public-private partnerships to do economic community development differently.
Yeah.
And we need the support of the community mm-hmm. to do that. Thelma's Kitchen is a beautiful example of the success of that kind of partnership. The neighborhood and the community at large coming together to bring something that is greater than the sum of the parts.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking today about Thelma's Kitchen at 3101 Troost, a pay-as-you-can eatery located right in the heart of the Troost neighborhood there. Who was Thelma? Can you tell us who she was, Pam? Because I wish I could have met her.
I wish I could have met her, too.
Yeah.
Thelma was married to Father
David Alschul, who is now Father Alexei. He's a monk. His wife, Thelma, passed away.
Ah.
But mm-hmm. she was just very well known in the community. And
she took care of people.
She took care of people. They had people living in their home. She fed people through food pantry, through a kind of a restaurant they operated called Grace's Kitchen out of where Thelma's Kitchen is now. And she was just beloved by the community. People still talk about her. People who knew her or knew of her still talk about her when they come into the restaurant.
And so when it came time to name your restaurant, was just natural? Was she a natural way to name
it? It was. We had a kind of a powwow between four of us on staff trying to figure out a name. And then someone said, Thelma's Kitchen, and we just all said, "Ah, oh, that's it. That's it. Yeah.
It just fit, mm-hmm. right?"
Thelma was the co-founder of not only Reconciliation Services, but also St. Mary of Egypt Orthodox Church, which is a separate organization, but in the same building. But in many ways, Thelma, we called her Mother Michaela. She went by that on you know, in everyday life. Thelma was very much the mother of Troost. She took care of people. I'll tell you, when in the 80s, when she had nothing herself and was living off of food stamps, she would go out on the streets of Troost using her own money and her own food to care for people who were on the streets, and she would bring them into her home. And so we've just been formed by that DNA, by that saintly example, and we are trying to follow in her footsteps as well as Father Alexei, who her husband, who was the co-founder of Reconciliation Services in our church.
You know, Pam, I'm wondering the customers who come into Thelma's Kitchen, how many of them pay over the suggested donation? Are you seeing quite a bit of that?
Yeah, I mean, our customers are so varied. They're from every walk of life. And
which is the idea.
That's
That's the culture you want to create
Yeah. And I would say it's about 40% who are paying and paying over. And then we have a lot of walk-in volunteers who are, you know, trading a half an hour of volunteer time for their lunch. And then we have sign-up volunteers who come in too. But it's really, the customer base is just, it's crazy wonderful. I mean, when you're sitting in there, we hear it all the time. Customers who come in for the first time just kind of sit around and look at what's happening because it's so magical, you know, that all these people are coming together and working together and eating together.
Well, speaking of magical, I'm eating in front of you here because you have brought me a dessert from Thelma's Kitchen, which is, of course, it's working really well for me right now. what am I eating here?
You're eating apple cinnamon bread pudding.
Oh, yes, I am.
Yes. With caramel sauce.
How popular is this?
It's pretty popular. We have it nearly every day, and when we don't have it, we say, you know, we hear about it.
People get upset. They don't like
that. Where's the bread pudding? Yeah.
Yeah. Father, I can't help but ask, as I try to ask a question as I'm eating the dessert here, this notion of pay what you can has failed in some iterations of it. Panera tried it. It didn't work. Why not, and how is this different?
You know, we call it a donate what you can model, and the idea of eating at Thelma's Kitchen is working because I believe that, first of all, those who don't have significant financial resources, you know what they have? They have themselves. They have so much to give, and we don't view Troost and our client guests as in any way at a deficit. They may not have the same amount of money that some have, but they have all the strength and all the personhood that we all have. And so our goal in Thelma's Kitchen is to reveal that hidden strength together, not doing for one another, but walking with one another. And so I think it's working because that cultural humility, as well as the perspective, that strength-based and trauma-informed approach is different than you would get walking into some other restaurant.
Well, Panera is obviously a well-known retail establishment. And is that the difference? It's seen as a successful enterprise that makes money, where your purpose and mission is something very different.
You know, I can't speak to Panera's model directly and its success or lack thereof. I did study that. In particular, I looked at some of the other models that were patterned off of it. I think what is making this work is that for 30 years, Reconciliation Services has poured itself and volunteers from local churches and corporations and people around the community have poured themselves into a vision of reconciliation. Mm-hmm. And I think that what's happening at 31st and Troost is bigger than just the food, and it's bigger than any one of us. It's really a healing movement, this idea that...
And Panera's didn't have that to offer, it doesn't sound like.
Right. And to be honest with you, I love Panera's food, but you haven't eaten until you've eaten at Thelma's Kitchen and tasted Pam's food. And Steve, when we did the job interviews, that was my favorite job interview series ever. I had everyone cooked. And as soon as Pamela cooked for us, it was done.
It was over.
It was done.
A done deal. Let's go to some phone calls. Johnny from the 43rd and Troost neighborhood. Good morning.
Steve, you're making me really hungry for that caramel pudding or whatever.
I'm eating it as we speak, Johnny.
I'm about to get in my car and go down there. I have lived at 43rd and Troost for 32 years. My house is paid off. And I think Thelma's Kitchen is the latest, greatest thing about it. But it's not the first thing. Troost has been coming back for years, and I am so sick of the entire metropolitan community stereotyping Troost as a dividing line between our communities. It is not. It was, but it's not now.
And Johnny, I appreciate that. And Pam, you're seeing the same thing. It sounds like you guys are singing out of the same playbook here.
Yeah. And honestly, it's really not, at least at Thelma's Kitchen, it's not. It's all people from all walks of life, East and West, black and white, all coming together.
Yeah, Father.
You know, one of the things that I think Johnny brings up that is very important is, you know, we may have been there for 30 years, but we're standing on the shoulders of giants. You know, we're standing on the shoulders of not only, you know, organizations that have names that are known, but also unsung heroes, people from all different walks of life who have given themselves for their neighbor. And I think he makes an excellent point. We're pleased to be talking about what we're doing. But the reason we named it after Thelma is precisely that. You know, she was somebody who lived it and walked it. Troost may not be for Johnny a dividing line the way that I talk about it, but I'll promise you, I can show you the math. You can go to our website at rs3101.org and you can see the stories. The 10 neighborhoods in particular and the 10 zip codes that we serve directly east of Troost are undeniably and categorically areas where there is significant struggling and significant suffering. And all you've got to do is cross over into one or two streets over and you see the difference.
Pam, just real quickly, for people who can't pay, who's covering that cost?
Well, we have some wonderful grants and people who have backed us up, but we also have our paying customers, and when they pay it forward, they pay big. And we also have a program called Lunch on Me KC, where corporate people can sign up and they bring the volunteers and donate. And we have a restaurant who started with us coming in once a month.
And we have a quick question from Jolene. She wants to know if your restaurant will be open on Thanksgiving.
No, it won't. It will not, but there are a lot of other community meals going on Thanksgiving.
Okay.
Yeah.
Pamela and Frank, food programs manager for Thelma's Kitchen, thanks so much, and thanks for the good work you do.
Thank you.
Father Justin Matthews, great to meet you. Thanks for coming in today and talking about the miracle of Thelma's Kitchen. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
That conversation originally aired in October of 2018, or actually I think that was 19. I'm joined It was 2018. We haven't even had October of 2019 yet. I'm all discombobulated because I'm enjoying some samples from Thelma's Kitchen, and I'm joined now by Pamela Infranca, the cafe and food program manager you just heard at Reconciliation Services. Pam, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
It's great to have you here, and if you keep bringing in food samples, you're going to get invited a lot more often onto the program. So last October, when you and Father Matthews talked with Steve, you said the program was working. You said the community was being brought together. Do you feel like that's still the case?
I do, even more so now. And, you know, a year in, we have worked out the kinks and, you know, done a lot of tweaking along the way. A real game changer for us was we got a just dynamo volunteer coordinator, which really changed things up in terms of workload. And so everything is just going really well.
Back in October, you were still getting a lot of first-timers, I imagine.
Yeah.
People who were just hearing about the place. The place was really busy. Have the numbers stayed high? Did they dip after a while?
They did not dip. They started out strong, and they have stayed strong. We serve around 100 people a day, give or take, and you know, that's about 500 meals a week. We have a lot of paying customers, and we also have so many regular walk-in volunteer customers and just people from the community, downtown businesses. So you see all kinds of people at Thelma's Kitchen.
Do you keep track of how many of the customers decide to pay something and how many decide they're not able to do that?
We do. And, you know, everyone pays something. And if there's nothing to pay, they are invited to volunteer for a half an hour. And so no one goes away without food. but we do. We're trying to attract more paying customers, you know, and flip that percentage just a little bit. But the people who do come are so generous that it just, it's all working.
Is there an average amount that people tend to pay for lunch?
There is an average. It's $5.53 is the average, but that includes the non-paying and the, you know, the pay it forward people. So yeah, it's great.
I have to say, you've brought in some samples of what's on the menu today. Tell people what we're enjoying now.
Well, it's Tenderloin Tuesday.
Ah.
So tenderloins, we make them every week, hand-breaded, made fresh. So you've had tenderloin sandwiches and then also our famous apple cinnamon bread pudding with caramel sauce.
Which you heard Steve talking with his mouth full.
Yeah.
This is what his mouth was full of when
yes,
you heard
it
in that interview. It is amazing. And I think if the average amount people are able to pay is $5.53, they would be paying a lot more than that for this Have things changed since you opened, or is that business model you started with, business model isn't probably the right word, but is it pretty much the same as when you started?
It's, you know, in some ways it's the same, in some ways it's different, and it is a business model. We are part of One World Everybody Eats, a nationwide network of Donate What You Can cafes. There are about 50 of them right now, and so we're very much modeled after that. It's changed just in the fact that we have so many regular community people. You know, it's just like any neighborhood restaurant. So there's just a comfort factor there, I guess. And we have a lot of really generous donors who come in on a regular basis. We've developed relationships with corporate and business through our Lunch on Meet KC program, where they come in and volunteer for the day. And so it has changed, but it's pretty much like it was when we started.
You heard a caller in that segment we just listened to together suggest that Troost shouldn't be seen as a dividing line. And yet there really is still a great deal of economic disparity, of racial division along Troost. That hasn't magically ended in the past year.
No.
Can you point to some tangible ways that maybe it is changing or your place is having an impact?
Yeah, well, for us, you know, we are at kind of a prime corner location where we have buses coming every direction, but we're also positioned very close to business downtown, Union Hill, Hyde Park, where there is a lot of money. And then, you know, we're on the dividing line. We're east and west. So we get all kinds of people coming together. So we don't really see it at Thelma's Kitchen. And part of the thing that's wonderful about Thelma's Kitchen is Reconciliation Services was there already. We're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
But it's great to invite other people into the mix.
So in a way, it sounds like you're sort of modeling what you would hope could become true in an even broader section of the city.
Most definitely, yeah.
As you look back on a year, what do you think is your greatest memory or a great moment that really stands out to you as what this place is really about?
Well, you know, because we're about to celebrate our one-year anniversary, when we started, my staff was a staff of all volunteers. We had no one who had restaurant experience. And the day we actually opened, when we had our grand opening, we had this big, extravagant invitation, you know, with numerous people, and the electricity went out.
Oh.
And, you know, and I was making my grandma's meatballs and, you know, trying to just plug along. I was about ready to have a nervous breakdown. But it just all worked, you know, and it's kind of been like that all along. There are always things that happen day to day and different crisis situations. But we have a great crew who works together, the community people who come in, back us up. So that's the greatest thing, you know, that it just has kept working from the beginning.
I can't congratulate you enough. It's such a neat project, and for the food to be as amazing as it is, that's pretty neat too.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That's Pamela Infranca. She's a cafe and food program manager at Reconciliation Services, which is to say she's the chef at Thelma's Kitchen at 31st and Troost. Check it out and pay what you can. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
If you joined us yesterday on the program, you heard us learn what's changed and what hasn't 5 years since a Ferguson police officer shot and killed Michael Brown. You can hear that conversation and other previous episodes at kcur.org/up-to-date. Find and follow us on Twitter. We're at @KCURUpToDate. I'm at @PTSBrian. Don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook, too. Steve Kraske's back tomorrow for a conversation about how a merger could affect one of the area's biggest companies and change the face of Kansas City. The show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.